I have a very important message at the start of this tape, strictly for adults and parents who will be supervising the instruction of this material with children. Now, this is a private message, so if you're not alone at this moment, then I'd suggest that you replace this tape with one of the others in the package and come back and listen to this one yourself before we go any further. The reason for that is because there's some controversial material coming up on the tape that follows, and I think you should have an opportunity to screen what I have said before your child hears it. You may disagree with my viewpoints here, and if you do, then you can erase my recording or just not play that section with your children. But the tape which follows discusses the physical changes which occur in adolescence and many of the unnecessary fears which are so common during that time. Now, these comments can be of great help to you and to your youngster in allaying his fears and normalizing the entire experience because there are tremendous fears associated with physical development. There's not very much controversial about that subject, and that's what's laid out primarily on the first half of the tape. But on the last half of the reverse side is a more specific discussion of sexual development itself. And it's virtually impossible to deal adequately with that topic without discussing guilt and God's view of certain sexual behavior. Now, you don't need me to tell you that that's a highly controversial subject. And different people are going to see it differently, even within the framework of Christianity. Some people have different concepts of what is right and what's wrong in this area. Some religious groups would consider any sexual arousal apart from a marriage partner to be synonymous with lust, as Jesus used the term. So just feeling sexual and feeling a sexual desire would be considered sin to these people. Others feel that lust and the sin necessarily involves the will. In other words, it becomes wrong, it becomes sinful when I will or I intentionally disobey God. Regardless of whether or not I actually carry out the act, it becomes wrong when I put myself in contradiction to his desires and will. Others, I suppose, feel guilt is only valid when the overt act itself is involved. Now, as a committed Christian myself, all of my psychological viewpoints, I feel, are consistent with the biblical principles which are so apparent throughout the Scripture. For example, I have strongly supported the prohibition of premarital intercourse on the tape which follows, because the Bible so clearly condemns it itself. But there is another area where you and I may disagree, because it's a very emotional topic. And I wanted to give you the opportunity to deal with this difference if it exists. In my psychological casework, I work with adolescent males who are literally crushed with guilt over masturbation. And the judgment of Almighty God hangs over them every day of their lives, and they're torn apart by their inability to rid themselves of this habit. And the guilt enters their dreams, and it produces physical disorder, and it's in no small number of them, it causes them to throw over their relationship with God because it's become impossible to serve him. Now, if you don't believe this, folks, you chat sometime with someone who will be totally honest with you. Talk to an adult and ask him what he went through during adolescence with the concept of masturbation. If he grew up in a rather fundamental Christian home, the chances are very great that this was a key matter in his own emotional development during adolescence. And knowing this and seeing the emotional discomfort associated with it, I have searched the Scripture for some indication of God's attitude toward this sexual response, and it simply isn't there. There's only one reference to masturbation which appears in the entire Bible, and this occurs in kind of a vague reference to it, a reference to the, quote, seed falling on the ground, unquote, in Mosaic law. And as you know, Mosaic law also commanded the people to stone a disobedient child, which is hardly appropriate today. There are a lot of things in Mosaic law which we are not bound to today. A woman who was in her menstrual period could not be touched. If she was touched, the hands had to be washed. There was a cleansing process. All the way through Mosaic law, there were restrictions and requirements on food and other factors which are not implemented today. So to go back to that reference and make it absolutely hard and fast with reference to today's time, I think is inappropriate. That is the only direct reference to masturbation in the Bible. And I personally do not believe that masturbation is much of a moral issue at all for these reasons. Number one, as I just implied, Jesus never mentioned it as a sin, although he listed the others very specifically. He got around to talking about most of the other things that are wrong, but he did not mention masturbation. It must have existed at that time, but he didn't apparently feel it necessary to talk about it. Number two, it is unreasonable to me that God would put a raging fire within an immature child, one that absolutely defies containment, and then to damn him for triggering it with the slightest stimulation. See, the sex drive is at a peak of intensity during adolescence. It's greater than it'll ever be later in life. And it's impossible, and I use that word advisedly, it is impossible for most boys to avoid this act entirely. I have seen them try it, and they make it for a week or two, but the object is all too available. It's right there. It's 24 hours a day. It's too accessible. And the hormonal pressure is much too intense to ignore for very long. And your boy will do it too. I guarantee it. You may not be aware of it, but your boy will do this too. Every competent medical and psychological authority estimates that the incidence of masturbation is somewhere between 95% and 99%. And no matter how you approach it, your male child will probably do this. All of the tricks to prevent it are laughable wives' tales. Now, we've been told to give the kids plenty of exercise and to give them cold showers and to give them light bed clothing and whatever. And these things are folly. They're foolish. Sexual expression will find its ventilation. And it just seems unlikely to me that God, who created this system, will repudiate the 99% who fall into its inevitable snare. That doesn't make sense to me, and I don't believe that it is much of a moral issue for that reason. Number three, whereas premarital intercourse is fraught with harmful consequences, physical and emotional, masturbation is actually thought to be healthy from an emotional and a sexual perspective. It releases the tension of a pressurized prostate gland, and it relaxes the quest for intercourse itself. I think your child is much less likely to be promiscuous when there is some form of release than when there is this constant pressure with no source of satisfaction. It provides an outlet at a time when there's no other form of release, you see. And there are only three occasions, to my mind, when masturbation is harmful. And they can be deadly. All three of them can be. One is when it's done in a group. Sexual energy can be very easily rechanneled during early adolescence, where a child change the object of his sexual interest from the opposite sex to the same sex. And I think it's very likely that homosexuality gets a good start by boys particularly masturbating as roommates in college perhaps, or in the earlier years through camping experiences or whatever, and then they share this activity and then of course explore each other's bodies. I think that's very dangerous and very destructive. The second time masturbation is dangerous is when guilt is maximal. See, guilt is always destructive to the mind and the body. And I wish you all who disagree with me at this point could talk to some of the boys that I see who suffer so greatly at this point. Many of them would control it if they could. They want to control it, but they don't know how. And since they're put in this unresolvable conflict where they are defying God Himself and yet are unable for very long to maintain this tremendous control that's required, then they constantly fail, and the result is deadly, spiritually, emotionally, physically, and other ways as well. The third time masturbation is harmful is when it becomes a substitute for sexual intercourse in marriage. And that's a very common thing. More and more in counseling, I am coming to the conclusion that men will lose the interest in their wives, perhaps because a romantic element has gone out of the marriage, and will turn back to the adolescent form of sexual gratification through masturbation. This is not at all uncommon on an adult level. It's extremely frustrating, obviously, for the women who are involved because they have no form of sexual release then, for their husbands can make it without them. That's very damaging. So this is my dilemma, folks, at this moment. I feel an obligation to those thousands, perhaps millions, of Christian young people, boys particularly, but girls are involved as well, who are undergoing hell on earth at this time, during this impressionable period of life, over this irrepressible urge within them. I don't encourage them to masturbate, and I haven't encouraged it on the tape which follows. But I think that they should know, prior to adolescence, that it is our opinion that God will not damn them for it, and nor will they suffer major catastrophic illness as a consequence. If you disagree with that viewpoint, and certainly you're free to do that, I think you still have to answer in your own mind what you're going to tell your boys about this subject. You're going to have to accept the fact that it's going to happen. No matter what you tell them, it's going to happen. You are free to try to prevent it from taking place, but it is a normal developmental pattern. It's almost like telling them not to be interested in the opposite sex. There is a biochemical force there which defies complete and total containment. And it will happen in your boy. And if you are going to tell him that God will damn him or destroy him for finding this form of private release, then I think you need to talk to him about the guilt that's involved and help him handle it, give him an opportunity to ventilate emotionally. I think it's a mistake to tell him that, but you have to decide that. And I haven't wanted to contradict your moral teachings with your child. My solution to the dilemma that I was in was to tell you here in advance what I've said on this subject, and then let you decide whether or not you'll share it with your child. So I suggest that you listen to the tape, particularly the back side of the tape near the end, and then decide what you will do. You can either erase it or just not let your child listen to it. Let me reiterate in closing that your male child will masturbate regardless of how you approach him. Your female child very well may do the same. I think the estimate for her is somewhere around 40% that will masturbate during adolescence. And you have to decide what God wants you to tell them about it. But may I urge you again, unless you have a very strong conviction to the contrary, set their minds at rest before masturbation becomes an issue. Thank you, and let's proceed now with the tape on physical and sexual development. Now we're going to discuss a matter of great importance to every one of you who is about to enter adolescence. And by that I'm referring to the changes that are about to occur within your own body. I'm sure that some of you, perhaps most of you, have noticed that adults are not just bigger than children. Their bodies are very different from those of children. They have a different purpose, and for this reason they're shaped differently and they work differently. And I want to talk to you about some of those differences for the next few minutes. For those of you between, we'll say, 10 and 13 years of age at this time, these changes that I'm going to discuss are about to happen within you right now. If you're already a teenager, then you'll know a little more about what I'll be saying. But this growing up process is a wonderful process. It's an interesting thing. And it's all controlled by a tiny little gland near the center of your head called the pituitary. And this little organ is about the size of a small pea or bean. And it's just a tiny little fellow, about half the size of a marble. But it's called the master gland because it tells the rest of the glands what to do. It's the big boss upstairs. And when it screams, everybody else jumps. Somewhere within this pituitary is a plan for your own body. And at just the right time, this little organ will send out chemicals called hormones, which give a message to the rest of the glands in the body, and they say, get going, get moving, it's time to grow up. And that has many implications for you in the next few years. Now, there are several reasons why you ought to know about all of this. First of all, if you don't know what's about to happen to your body, it can be pretty terrifying when everything goes crazy all at one time. It's not unusual for a young teenager to begin to worry about himself. Do I have a disease? What's going on here? Could this be cancer? Is there something wrong with my body? Do I dare discuss it with anybody? And so many teenagers worry in silence about their health, because they don't know what to expect. They don't know what's coming. They didn't know that this was a normal, natural process that they should have been anticipating. So I'm going to tell you in just a moment or two exactly what you can look for and what to expect, because there's just no reason for you to have to be anxious over this event of growing up. Secondly, we need to talk about the timing of all these changes. When does it occur? How does it occur? Because so many teenagers worry, like everything, when their own body changes occur later than it does in their friends. And they start being concerned about whether or not there's something wrong with them for that reason. So we'll get back to that matter. Okay, let's talk specifically about what is about to take place within your body. What can you expect to happen and in what manner? But before I go into that, I want to ask you to be very mature about what you're about to hear. Don't let it embarrass you, because it's childish and juvenile to snicker and giggle about something as beautiful and as wonderful as the body which God gave us. It's just nothing to laugh at or to get embarrassed over. So I'm going to talk to you, whether you're in a group or whether you're alone or whether you're with one other person. I'm going to talk to you as though you were already grown up. I just refuse to treat you like a baby, and I'm going to use some terms which adults use, because you'll soon be one yourself. And if you're in a group, I hope each of you will show a very grown-up attitude towards what you're about to hear, because it's a grown-up subject, and I'm sharing grown-up information with you. The most important change that you will soon notice is that your body will begin to prepare itself for parenthood. Now, I didn't say that you're about to become a parent. That should be years away. But your body is about to equip itself with the ability to produce a child. That's one of the major changes that occurs in puberty. Incidentally, puberty is this period of change that I was talking about. Now, let's talk first about what will happen to a boy's body, and then we'll talk about girls. To start with, boys will grow very rapidly, faster than ever before in your entire life. And your muscles will become much more like a man's muscles than those of a little boy. And you'll get much stronger than you were. And you should be quicker and better coordinated. See, this is why a junior high boy is a much better athlete, usually, than a fifth or sixth grade boy, and why a high school boy is a better athlete than a junior high boy. There's a rapid change that takes place in his overall body size, his strength, and his coordination during this time. Secondly, the hair on your body will begin to look more like the hair of a man. You'll notice the beginnings of a beard on your face, and you'll have to start shaving it every now and then. Hair will also grow under your arms for the first time, and also in what we call the pubic region, or what you may have called a private area around your sex organs. And speaking of the sex organs, they themselves will become larger and more like an adult's. You see, these are evidences that the little boy is leaving forever, and in his place will come a man capable of working and taking care of his wife and family, and capable of becoming a father. See, it's a fantastic thing. It reminds me in some ways of a caterpillar, which spins a cocoon around itself and stays for a while and then comes out as a totally different creature, a butterfly. Now, the changes in man are not that dramatic, but it's a similar idea. There's a rapid change that occurs just around the corner for most of you. And the frightening thing to some kids is that these changes begin to occur very suddenly, almost overnight. Boom! The pituitary begins kicking everybody into action. It's barking its orders right and left, and your whole body is racing around inside, trying to carry out these orders. Everything is affected. Even your voice will be changed. I'm sure you've noticed how much lower your dad's voice is than your own. Have you ever wondered how it got that way? Has it always been that way? Has it always sounded like a foghorn? Can you imagine your dad in his crib as a baby saying, goo, goo, goo? Of course not. It's ridiculous. He wasn't born that way. His voice changed during puberty, and that's going to happen to your voices too. And I'm speaking to the boys, of course. Now, the voice is sometimes an embarrassment to boys because until this change is finished, it just doesn't sound very solid. It will squeak and screech and wobble and crack for a few months, but don't worry about it because it'll soon be deep and steady, and it just takes a little time to complete this change that's occurring. As you may be understanding by now, practically every part of your body is affected one way or another by puberty. Everything. Even your skin will undergo major changes. In fact, this is probably the most distressing aspect of all the changes that take place for boys and girls. The facial skin of your face, will become much more oily, and the pores of the skin tend to fill up with this oil and block themselves. The oil can't get out and it hardens there, and it causes a little blemish called a pimple or a blackhead. So for several years you might expect to have these imperfections in your skin, these blemishes. And for some of you, your face will be broken out most of the time. That's called acne, where you get these imperfections or blemishes over a good part of your face most of the time. Now, if this happens, it will be very important for you to keep your face clean, to get that oil off of your face, and to watch what you eat, because certain greasy foods contribute to the problem. Now, there are doctors who specialize in skin problems, and they're called dermatologists, and I would suggest that you ask your parents to take you to see one of these medical specialists if your skin really begins to bother you. I saw a study the other day of 1,500 teenagers who were asked what one thing bothered them most, what one thing caused them the most worry and the most concern, and what they most disliked about themselves. And the most common answer was skin problems. There are ways to help solve these problems, so don't worry about it in silence if it happens to you. Get your parents to help you find a solution for it. Another physical thing that happens to both boys and girls during puberty is fatigue and a lack of energy a good part of the time. You'll be investing so much of your bodily energy into growing, and readjusting to this shift of gears that I've been describing, that you seem to lack energy for other things for a period of time. That phase doesn't last very long, though, and it's nothing to worry about. But here's something that you ought to know, which many adults don't even understand. You will actually need more rest during puberty than you did when you were 9 or 10 years old. And why? Because all of the growth I've been talking about. When you become a teenager, you feel like you shouldn't have to go to bed as early as when you were a child, so you sit up late, and then you drag through the next exhausted day because you needed more rest than you got. And if your parents are listening, I would suggest that they let you sleep in on Saturday morning, if possible, so that you can get somewhat rested at least. You know, parents just can't stand to see that big rascal lying in bed till 9:30 in the morning on Saturday when they want him to mow the lawn or do some other job, clean out the garage. But I think it would be a good idea now and then to allow teenagers, adolescents, to sleep in and then mow the lawn when they wake up. And another thing, what you eat will be very important during adolescence. Your body has to have the raw material, the building blocks, with which to construct those muscle cells and the bones and the fiber that you'll be needing. And hot dogs and hamburgers and donuts and malts just won't do the job. And it'll be very important for you to get a balanced diet during this time. Even more important, if you can believe it, than when you were 5 or 6 or 7 or 8. If you don't eat right during this growth period, you'll pay the price in sickness and physical weakness of various sorts, because your body just has to have the vitamins and the minerals and the protein necessary to enlarge itself in so many ways. All right, let's talk for a few moments now about the many, many changes that will occur specifically with girls during the years of puberty. If anything, a girl's body goes through even more complicated changes than a boy's, because her body has to prepare itself for the very complicated matter of motherhood. It is a beautiful thing, the way human life begins as one tiny little cell, a little cell so tiny that you couldn't even see it without a microscope. And it's called a zygote when it's just one cell like that, and we all begin at that point inside the mother's uterus. Now, the uterus is a special place inside the mother's lower abdomen, or what you may have called the stomach. Actually, it's not in the stomach at all, it's below it. And it's a special little pouch there, a perfect environment for a little embryo, which is what you call a baby when it's in a very early stage, to grow and develop. And all that it needs there for warmth and oxygen and nourishment are met automatically by the mother's body. It's a beautiful thing. Any little slip-up during those very early days and that growing child would die. It's extremely delicate during that time. And the mother's body has to be right there to meet every requirement of that growing child. Now, in order to do this job and to do it right, a young girl's body undergoes so many changes during early puberty. One of those important developments is called menstruation, which I'm sure that you've heard about before. If not, this is a subject that you'll want to know a lot more about, because it's so important to understanding yourself in the days ahead if you're a girl. And I think it's important for boys to understand too, because this has been a subject so frequently that boys did not understand, and it was just something confusing to them. So what I'm going to say is for boys and girls, but I can only give you a brief outline of this subject here on tape. You'll want to see pictures and charts, which will make it all more reasonable, particularly for the girls who are going to experience this before too long. Most schools provide this information to girls in the 5th or 6th grade, so what I'll tell you is just an introduction to what you'll see and hear elsewhere if it hasn't occurred already. But let me say this. Now, when a woman becomes pregnant, That is, when the one cell, or the zygote, is planted in her uterus, as I mentioned before, her body begins to help it grow in many, many ways. It has to have oxygen and food, and many chemicals have to be brought to it by the mother's body. These things are delivered to the uterus automatically through the mother's blood. But the uterus, you see, the mother's uterus has no way of knowing when a new life is going to be planted there. So every month it gets ready to receive one just in case it comes, you see. So there's a buildup of blood on the walls of the uterus every month to be ready just in case a woman becomes pregnant and an embryo has to be nourished there in her body. But you see, if she does not become pregnant in that month, then the blood that's there to nourish it is not needed. And that blood is released from the uterus walls and out through the vagina, or the special opening through which babies are also born. Now, I don't want to take you too fast through this. Some of you have heard the details before, and it may be completely new and confusing to others of you. So I suggest that if you did not understand what I said, or what I will say, that you run the tape back and forth and listen to it again and again until you begin to feel that it's more clear. You might also take what I've said and let it create questions in your mind that you ask your mother or your father or your doctor or somebody that can fill in the gaps that I don't make too clear. But what I'm saying is this: about every month or every 28 days in most women, a woman's body will get rid of this unnecessary blood which would have been used to take care of a baby if she had become pregnant.
The remainder of this message is on side two. Please turn cassette over at this point.